This is Lars. Thanks again for checking out my podcast. Enjoy your day and the show, and let's make America great again. Are you approaching retirement, or maybe you've just changed jobs? If so, you'll probably now have control of your 401k or IRA. Would you like to buy some property, notes, loans, start a new business, or even buy crypto? You can with a self-directed IRA. For more than a decade, I've been telling you about setting up a self-directed IRA through IRA Advantage. And while you may now hear other companies say they offer self-directed IRAs, you need to find out if they're truly self-directed. With a truly self-directed retirement account, you can make any investment the law allows. Whether you're talking about true diversification, starting your new business, or investing in private holdings, IRA Advantage through a truly self-directed IRA can make that happen. Take it from me, Lars. You've worked hard for your money. IRA Advantage will work hard to keep it yours.
Would you like to learn more about truly self-directed IRAs? Then visit IRAAdvantage.com. View our videos and call IRA Advantage. That's IRAAdvantage.com.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's Conspiracy Theory Thursday, and boy, do I have a good one for you. It involves a crazy man. It involves charges of murder out of Idaho. It involves charges of assault out of Washington State. And it involves a system that says this guy is too crazy to put him on trial. So we've got to find him a bed at Western State Hospital, the crazy house. And then after almost a year, they still can't find him a bed. So where is he? Running around the Pacific Northwest, and now the police in Idaho say that he has committed murder and murdered two people. I'll give you the details in just a moment. In the meantime, welcome to the best conversation you'll ever have in talk journalism. It's honestly provocative talk for the Pacific Northwest, and you're welcome to take part at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. You can send emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. You can vote in our Twitter poll, and if you thought that theory, the one I just mentioned to you, is not crazy, how about this one? Should death certificates in Pacific Northwest states show your real gender or the one you identify with? It turns out that they're now raising a fuss because they're saying sometimes people die, and they actually put the person's real biological gender on the death certificate instead of the one that they most closely identify with. Should we change that? Now, my answer to that would be no. You can answer any way you like. You'll find the Twitter poll at Lars Larson Show on Twitter and also at our website at LarsLarson.com. And always brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at UltimateTruckService.com. Now, yesterday's Twitter poll. Should Washington State go forward with its plans to add 46 cents a gallon to the cost of gasoline? Now, what we're talking about is a cap and tax scheme that was pushed by Jay Inslee. He claims it's going to save the planet from global warming by raising the cost of gasoline for you by almost half a dollar on January 1st of next year. So we're only talking about a couple of months from now. And we already have high gasoline prices. And as I told you yesterday, the OPEC nations have now announced they're going to tighten down on the valve just a little bit. They're going to cut 2 million barrels a day of production. That is going to raise prices even more. So if you're happy with the Joe Biden-flation gas prices you're seeing right now, you're going to be really happy in January when Jay Inslee jacks up the cost of every gallon of gas by another nearly half a dollar. I said no to that idea. I suggested that the Washington legislature, the nitwits in Olympia, and if you're not one of the nitwits, you actually vote for sensible things. I'm not talking about you. But the nitwits in Olympia could say, yes, we had planned to add almost half a dollar a gallon to the cost of gasoline, but in the middle of a recession, in the middle of the biggest inflation that America or the Northwest has seen in the last 40 years, maybe that's not such a good idea, especially with the supply chain problems staring us right in the face. Can you imagine how much of a supply chain problem there's going to be when you add almost 50 cents a gallon to the cost of every gallon of diesel? Because even if you're one of those people who says, well, I don't use gasoline because I don't own a car, or I have a Tesla that's at least powered by coal in part, and you say, I don't need any of these fossil fuels, guess what? every single bite of food that sits on your plate every morning or every night, every single stitch of clothing you wear on your body, every single thing you own came to where you bought it on a truck or a train or a ship or all three. And when you jack up the cost of fuel like this, whether you own a gasoline-powered internal combustion engine or not, you're going to be paying part of the cost. So I said no. 91% of you said no to the idea of Washington State jacking up gas taxes and diesel taxes by another 46 cents a gallon. Only 9% of you said yes. But I'd love to hear from the 9%. The naysayers to this show are endlessly entertaining. So if you want to join the best conversation around, it's 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk at LarsLarson.com. Now, how's this for a conspiracy theory? There's a guy out there, and he is now suspected of two murders that didn't need to happen. His name is John Cody Hart. Now, I will talk in, you know, legal terms. He was accused of assault one and assault two right in the county I live in, Clark County, Washington, Vancouver, is what we're talking about. August of last year, he was accused of assault one and assault two. The problem is he's got a prior criminal record and he's got a prior record of problems with his own mental health. So his lawyers went into court and they told the judge, listen, you can't put this guy on trial. He's crazy. So a judge last year, more than a year ago, actually at this point, ordered that he be sent to Western State Hospital, which is Washington State's mental health hospital, to try to restore his competency. Well, there's a problem. He sat in jail for a long time. He sat in jail until July 22nd of this year. And July 22nd, just a few months ago, his lawyers went back into court and they said, Judge, our client is crazy. He needs to go to the loony bin. And you can't put him on trial, and you've been holding him in custody for way too long. You have to cut him loose. Now, the prosecutor in Clark County, Luka Vitasovic, told the judge, well, he's set to be admitted on August the 1st. That was just another 9 days in the future. Turns out that wasn't true either. But the judge, Robert Lewis, said, you know what? The guy needs to go to the mental hospital. You don't have any room for him. You can't keep holding him in jail. So the judge, Robert Lewis, sided with the defense attorney and said, let this guy out of jail, but keep him on supervised release. Now, that was just a few months ago. Now, guess what? Just a short time ago, just a few days ago, literally, the man is suspected by police because they picked him up at the scene in Washington County, Idaho. He is suspected of murdering a couple who owned and operated the Heartland Inn in New Meadows, Idaho. A 45-year-old woman, Sarah Mahon, and a 47-year-old man, Rory Mahon, they owned this Heartland Inn. They think that this man, John Cody Hart, 28 years old, and already got a long, long list of problems, that he was staying at that inn, and that he murdered the couple. That's what the police say happened. They picked him up a short time after they found the couple dead in the main office of the place. They found him out on Highway 95 in Washington County, Idaho. Now, here's the problem. He should have been in the state mental hospital. There is no room in the hospital. And I'll remind you that just a couple of years ago, Jay Inslee, yes, the same guy with the bright idea to jack up gasoline prices January 1, he screwed up the operations of Western State Hospital so badly that the federal government cut off about $50 million in federal aid that helped run the hospital because they said, you're not following the rules, Jay. He screwed things up. There hasn't been any room at the inn for people like John Cody Hart. So a judge lets him go. The police say he came to Idaho, murdered a couple, and now he's facing murder charges, and the prosecutor says he's going to seek the death penalty. Consider the disaster our criminal justice system has become. In a moment, coffee shops and cops and the disaster that happens there. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show on the Radio Northwest Network.
That makes a lot of sense, a lot of nonsense.
Right, you're bloody well right. You know you got a right to say. This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead fish wrapper or mainstream media bias.
I don't hate the cops, and I'm guessing that most of you don't hate the cops either. But sadly, too many in Portlandia subscribe to the Antifa, all cops are bastards mantra. Case in point, the owner of the Bison Coffee House. A group of criminals launched a concerted attack on her business in Northeast Portland. And what inspired this assault? Why, coffee with a cop. Loretta Guzman makes her living selling cups of Joe to folks in the Cully neighborhood. When police asked her to host a two-hour event to let people in the area sit down and get to know the local cops, and so officers could actually hear their citizen concerns, Ms. Guzman readily agreed. She even advertised the opportunity. Ms. Guzman apparently forgot that in a town that constantly pats itself on the back for tolerance and diversity and inclusion, all that good PC woke garbage, the only thing... Well, it only applies to things that the PC woke crowd endorses. So six of these criminals trashed her business, broke windows for no reason other than working with the police for public safety. Mobs in the streets have spent the last couple of years demanding the defunding of police. City Hall delivered what they wanted, and a crazy DA sent the message loud and clear, if you commit crimes for the cause of chaos, no punishment will follow. I hope right-thinking folks will help Ms. Guzman clean up the mess and then flood Bison Coffee House with new business. And when they catch the criminals, demand that the DA actually do his job and throw the book at them. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
The way has been paved by Trademark Paving. Just pave it. Serving Southwest Washington.
Well, today's Daily Grill, and it's going to sound familiar to some of you, but Oregon and Washington both legalized pot with effectively no limits on the potency. And now, finally, some of the folks are waking up. Even the Seattle Times fish wrapper, the Daily Times, has a story about dabs. Now, if you're not into the marijuana world, you don't know what they are. I had to educate myself on it. Cake batter is one of them. It is 65% THC. And they say that's not the worst of it. Some of the dabs sold contain as much as 90% THC. And as the Times puts it, such products are setting off alarm bells for physicians and a group of research scientists in the Pacific Northwest who see the wide availability of dabs and other highly concentrated substances as a quiet but growing threat to public health, especially among young adults and even teenagers. And then I'd point this out. Turns out that even the CDC is saying now some people who use pot will develop marijuana use disorder. Known as MUD, I guess, meaning that they are unable to stop using pot, even though it's causing them health and social problems. One study figures about 30% of people who regularly use pot are going to end up with marijuana use disorder, and they won't be able to quit. So much for all those claims during the legalization debates about, well, you can't get addicted to pot. Turns out, apparently you can. Today's best email, but you can always send more to talk@LarsLarson.com. Brought to you by Mobile Joe's RV Collision. Get back on the open road and back to your adventure with Mobile Joe's. No body damage, too big or small. Collision or paint repairs, Mobile Joe's RV Collision fixes them all. Tim Pyatt, retired U.S. Army, writes in, Lars, could you imagine a Republican governor in the state of Oregon? So I am 56 years young, and I can't even remember the last Republican governor. I'm thinking they're just teasing us when they say Drazen has a... lead. I remember watching Chris Dudley win all night until, you guessed it, when they counted the three big counties in the Portland area, and he lost by 3 to 5 points. The riots that will follow if Drazen wins will be massive. I mean, when a coffee shop can't even hold an event in support of the police, what do you think will happen in the city of Portland if a Republican actually wins? Go Republicans, signed Tim Pyatt. And on that note, it's a pleasure to welcome to the program the owner of the Bison Coffee House, Loretta Guzman. Ms. Guzman, thanks for coming on today.
Thank you.
I understand that your shop was attacked by some people who did quite a bit of damage. Would you mind telling my audience what they did to you?
They busted out all my front big picture windows, my side windows to my front entrance, and my front door, and they... sprayed the whole inside of my, they didn't come in, they did it from all from outside. Once they got the windows busted open, then they sprayed my whole inside with white paint.
And all of this just to do damage to your shop, but you believe you knew, you know why they did it.
I mean, I can assume, you know, I posted the evening before that I was hosting Coffee with a Cop. You know, I've done it in the past, and the community, you know, is able to come and sit down with the police and voice their opinions and their concerns, or, you know, just be able to sit down whatever they have questions about or what they would like to, you know, I don't know, just I don't sit in with their conversation, but I have opened that door in the past. I think I've done it like maybe three times prior, like maybe 2015, 16, 17, somewhere around there, you know, and people are able to talk to them, you know, and I, so they asked me, it's been a while since we done it, and they came and asked me, you know, you're the first one, we wanted to ask and see if you would be open to doing Coffee with a Cop on Tuesday, Tuesday the 5th? My days are all kind of confused right now, but I was like, I told him, yeah, I said, okay, well, yeah, we can do it, you know, because, I mean, I hear the people's concerns, you know, and their worries and, you know, just different things with all the changes we have, all the things that are going on. You know, this is the, you know, the community, and they do talk to me, but I mean, I don't go and, you know, discuss their concerns and stuff. Like sometimes they just, you know, need to get it out, or, you know, they're upset about different things, or, you know, they're happy about other things they're not. And
I mean, Ms. Guzman, the Cully neighborhood has its share of problems, doesn't it?
It has what?
It has its share of problems. I mean, there can be things there where you need the cops.
Yeah. Yes. Yes, it is. I mean, not everybody can like protect themselves. You know. I mean, we got a lot of we got people who are older and who do need assistance. You know, and if they need to call the police need to be able to come. During the pandemic, they were not able to come at all. Not even for businesses.
Did you ever think you'd, Ms. Guzman, did you ever think you'd get that kind of reaction to just holding Coffee with a Cop?
Well, I did it, like I said before, in the past, and I didn't. And so, I mean, I know it's, you know, the past several years have been real rough for us and for a lot of other places. And so I knew it was kind of standing on shaky ground, but I was like, you know, we got to somehow make change. We got to be able to, even though you don't have to like them, you don't have to, you know, but if you have questions or concerns, at least you'll have a platform to be, you know, be able to voice your opinion, and maybe they can listen to you if they're willing to listen to you, and maybe they can make some changes too, because they got their, this is just me thinking, they got their daily jobs and duties they need to do. But if they don't hear from us, then they don't know.
Absolutely right. That's Loretta Guzman. She's the owner and operator of the Bison Coffee House, attacked after she announced that she was going to have Coffee with a Cop. In a moment, we'll be back and talk about the possibility, maybe even the certainty, that Oregon will end up with a new Republican governor. Come back to the Lars Larson Show. It's Conspiracy Theory Thursday, and we've got a bunch of them going already. And now we've got Aaron Mesh, news editor for Willamette Week. Aaron, what's going to happen is the at your paper, you know that I'm in favor of Christine Drazen, the Republican candidate, winning as governor of Oregon. But what do you suppose the reaction will be from the editors and staff of your own operation if Oregon has a Republican governor for the first time in more than one third of a century?
We'll probably go to work again the following day.
Okay, fair enough. So tell me about this. I mean, you've got a story, Connor Radnovich, it's a new name I've got to get used to, but one of your writers says 4 years ago, the last time Oregon elected a governor, Christine Drazen had never held elected office. She wasn't influential, well-known, or feared. Today, polling suggests she could be Oregon's next governor. And all of the polls for the last 4 months seem to show that Betsy Johnson's much-vaunted campaign can't seem to break out from below 20%, which doesn't even put her in the running at this point, does it?
Well, I think it makes her a very interesting spoiler, right?
Yep.
So I think at this point, the question for both the Drazen camp and the Kotek camp is to what degree is Johnson going to take away partisan voters. So at this time, and this is the most recent polling from John Horvick over at DHM, it looks like that Johnson is taking more Democrats than she is Republicans, which is why, despite a voter registration edge for Democrats, it looks like Drazen has a 1 to 3 point margin right now.
Well, and Aaron, I got to remind you that I think it was a couple of months ago that I advanced what I was told was a crazy theory, and that was that a former Democrat who is still pro-abortion and has even softened her support of Second Amendment rights was going to pull more from the Democrat nominee than it was from the Republican. And people said, no, that's crazy. Betsy's going to pull lots of conservative votes. And I said, I don't think so, but okay, whatever you want to say, I'm going to stick with my theory. I thought it was always the likelihood that you would pull more from the Democrat, from Tina Kotek, who's I think, a little crazy and not very well liked, even among her own party members, including the current governor, a fellow Democrat. They don't apparently like each other very much at all.
Well, remember that Nigel wrote a story for us back in April that said none of the four or five people who previously held this office in the Democratic Party were willing to endorse Tina Kotek at that time in the primary. And that struck us as noteworthy, and a lot of people in our readership howled at us, saying that it was sexist and mean and conservative of us to ask that question. And I think that time has proven us correct, that there is a certain hesitancy within the Democratic Party's moderate base that doesn't feel a lot of enthusiasm for Kotek's candidacy.
Aaron, you just brought up something that's always bothered me. I mean, if you want to make some critical comment about somebody, anybody who's a member of a beleaguered group, whether it's a racial minority, gender minority, or whatever, all of a sudden it's racist or sexist. How is it sexist to say the person isn't very likable even among her traditional friends, but if she's a woman, it's a sexist comment? But if it's a guy, you can say, well, you know, Donald Trump, a lot of people don't like him. Okay, that's fine. But nobody sees it as sexist or genderist or racist to say that. Do you get a little tired of that definition that every time you want to be critical of somebody who's part of a racial minority group or a gender minority group, although women do actually technically outnumber us and they run the show in many cases, that all of a sudden it's a sexist comment because you're actually telling people what folks actually think about the candidate?
Well, I don't really pay any attention to it, to be honest with you, nor do I pay that much attention when conservatives write me and say that we called someone right wing, and why don't we ever call anybody left wing, left wing? I mean, everybody works the refs. Like, you ever watch a basketball game? Like, every time the refs are playing and Russell Westbrook doesn't get a call that he wants, he starts like screaming and raising his hands in the air. And that's what I see almost every complaint about narrative being about, is you're not winning the thing you want today, so you're going to tell me that it's my fault. That's what it is to be in the press. I'm just a referee.
Well, by the way, do you think that at this point, I sense that even Tina Kotek realizes she's about to lose this, which is why in the debate the other night, she decided to go out and slam the current governor, a fellow Democrat, at least a couple of specific times, and that she probably wouldn't have done that if she wasn't feeling a bit of desperation at this point in the race.
I think that the Kotek campaign feels some concern, yeah. I mean, I think that this race being as close as it is, this close to Election Day, is something that they should have expected, and I'm not sure that they did expect it.
Yeah, so what happens after this? Because Betsy Johnson, having departed from the Democrat Party, but she's still got the Democrat Party in her background for the last 20 years, she's going to be persona non grata with everyone, except maybe the Republicans if she helps a Republican win, and it looks like that's what she's doing right now.
Well, Johnson's no longer in public life after this, right? This was her swan song, as it were.
And then what happens to Tina Kotek?
What do you mean what happens? Like, she gets to like eat really nice food and go to the beach. Like, what else does she have to do?
Well, that's it. She can retire from politics at the right. But how old is she now? Mid-40s or something? I mean, you'd think she'd have a political career ahead of her.
Sorry, you're referring to Kotek. Excuse me.
No, I did Johnson first. I did Kotek second, because Kotek is pretty much done at this point, I would think. if she loses?
Well, there is a seat held in Congress by Earl Blumenauer.
Oh, God.
And he just he won't commit that he's planning to run forward again. He won't say this is my last bite at the apple. But I think the odds are that Earl Blumenauer finishes up his term in 2024, and you see everyone run for the bluest seat in Congress, except maybe one or two in Massachusetts, right?
Yep,
like, there are
I agree.
Very few districts. There are very few districts, other than a couple that maybe the one held by Barney Frank out in Massachusetts was more blue than the one that Earl more safely blue than the one that Earl holds in Portland. And so that seat will be a free for all of my good friends on the left.
Well, I hope that Drazen wins. I've said that I don't think she's the perfect Republican, but she's a Republican. She's good enough. And frankly, Kotek doesn't offer much. And lately, it seems like she's throwing out my latest crazy idea to hear from her is that we're going to have meth daycare centers set up to take care of people who are currently high and psychotic. And this is her great idea for fixing the problems of a state that has more than its share of drug problems.
Well, I'm not sure what you're referring to, but there has been this terrible gap in Portland for the past 2.5 years of a lack of a sobering center that would also treat methamphetamine psychosis. A lot of these people are ending up in the hospitals or at the Unity Center, which are incapable of taking care of them, especially with the strengthening of the potency of methamphetamine. Speaking as someone who lives in this city, I would be grateful for any place that those folks go that isn't on my street.
The only thing is, if you're psychotic and you are on drugs at the time, it sounds like you do need the care of a medical facility, not just with boozers, maybe a sobering facility where you just sleep it off, buddy. I'm not sure that works as well for psychotic methamphetamine users, does it? Don't you need medical help?
Why the sobering center, that's why the sobering center closed, because the degree that people who were under the effects of methamphetamine were injuring themselves and others inside that sobering center were fairly horrifying. You can't just reopen that place. You have to entirely rethink it. What I'm saying is that one of the things that our editorial board is considering very seriously is who is to blame for not having thought up a new system in this city where people are sent when they...
You can point in almost any direction, find a suspect for that one. Aaron Mesh, the news editor at Willamette Week, we'll be back in just a moment. You've got the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'll be glad to get you your phone calls and emails in just a moment. If you want to dial in, it's 866-HEY-LARS. And naysayers, you always go right to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. Our Twitter poll today, and you can find it at Lars Larson Show on Twitter. I'm kind of glad we stuck with Twitter now, because it sounds like Elon Musk is going to end up owning the show, and it sounds like he'll open it back up to conservative points of view. I don't have to worry about getting banned for calling somebody a snowflake, as we once got banned, or I once got banned from Twitter for calling Sarah Ian Arone a snowflake, and she really is a snowflake. Should death certificates here in the Pacific Northwest show your actual biological gender or the one that you identify with? As the Fish Wrapper puts it, a first-of-its-kind study by epidemiologists in multiple Oregon counties found an accuracy error in death certificates for those who identified as transgender or non-binary. It's got to be a fairly small number, I would guess. Researchers found more than half of these individuals were misgendered on their death certificates. Well, if a death certificate is a public record, should the public record reflect what the actual facts are or what's going through your head? I vote for actual facts in that case. I mean, call me crazy. Today's Twitter poll is brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. Let's go to Marcus. Hey, Marcus, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Thank you for having me, Lars. How are you doing today?
I'm doing quite well today, as a matter of fact. What's on your mind?
Well, I'm calling on the traffic jam here in between Kaiser and just outside of Kaiser here in my Tesla. I love that Elon Musk. I'm glad he's taking that Twitter over.
You like that Tesla, huh? Okay.
I was surprised to hear you complain about 90% cannabis oil, 90% THC cannabis oil. What is it that you think ought to be done about that?
Well, I think that just as with alcohol, you should have some limits. And in fact, an awful lot of cities and counties have limits on the potency of alcoholic beverages. They also have limits on the number of stores where you're allowed to sell booze in bottles. At least they do in the state of Oregon, which continues to be a temperance state. They literally say you can only have so many liquor stores authorized by the state. But with pot stores, you can't drive a few hundred yards in most places in Oregon without seeing another pot store on another corner. They're almost as ubiquitous as coffee stops.
I've never known you to be someone who would agree with the OLCC and greater regulation. Can you tell me more?
Well, I'll tell you what. If you're inviting me to tell you more, I would like to see less regulation. The problem is that when you create the kind of problems that pot has created, all the way through the legalization debate, I heard people saying, well, we'll have fewer law enforcement problems. We appear to have more law enforcement problems, and I've cited that any number of times. We now have Mexican drug cartels Let me finish. Did alcohol ever bring human slavery to Oregon?
And you're saying the cannabis did?
No, I'm asking you the question. Did alcohol ever bring human slavery to Oregon? It's a simple question, yes or no?
Not that I'm aware of.
Okay, well, on this show, we have had sheriffs from Southern Oregon who have found cartel-operated illegal marijuana plantations that are being operated using hundreds of human slaves, most of them illegal aliens, and some of them die. Now, that's an aspect of pot that you can't say, well, alcohol does the same thing or tobacco does the same thing. Right?
That's a little far-fetched there.
What's far-fetched? That there are human slaves being working?
There is also human slavery in prostitution as well, if I understand correctly.
No, we dealt with the problems of human slavery in the 13th and 14th Amendments. So when you say it's still in the Constitution, what part of the Constitution says human slavery is okay?
I'm referring to the human trafficking aspect.
Which human trafficking aspect? Where in the Constitution does it say that human trafficking is okay?
And where in the Constitution, I'm wondering, it's against the law.
Yeah, it is against the law, but if you haven't noticed, the promise of marijuana legalization by the people who promoted it was we will have fewer criminal problems if we legalize it, and we now have bigger criminal problems than we've ever had before. In fact, the Oregon State Police estimate...
No.
Go ahead.
We have fewer criminal problems for the people who used to be considered criminal.
What do you mean? People who grow pot illegally and sell pot illegally, Oregon has become a haven for them because of the cover of legalized pot. They can then come here and they run gigantic operations. I mean, operations that are so big, they count the plants in the hundreds of thousands. And they are so big, they have to use human slaves to actually operate those plantations. So, that is a problem. And if you say, well, alcohol has the same problem, really, show me where that is. Where is somebody running a human slavery operation to get a bottle of whiskey or a bottle of wine into Oregon?
So you're talking about, so I didn't ask about that question. I asked about what you wanted to do about 90% THC oil.
And I told you, I think there should be sensible limits on it because we're going to damage an awful lot of people. Well, yeah, and in this case, of course, you're going to have to do something because the human damage that happens ends up being the problem for all the rest of us. And you don't believe me, drive down the street and look at the homeless camps full of drug addicted people. Lars here with a question for you. Why is it that some people aren't as stressed out about the future as you'd think they would be? The answer? They're probably among the millions of Americans who prepared themselves with emergency food storage from My Patriot Supply. If the worst ever happens, literally millions of American families are already protected from dealing with those empty store shelves. Is yours? Mine is. If not, go to MyPatriotSupply.com right now and grab some emergency food kits, at least one for every member of your family. These kits give you a wide variety of delicious meals that average over 2,000 calories per day. That's what you need. Everything stays fresh for up to 25 years in storage. Order your kits right now by going to MyPatriotSupply.com. Your order ships fast and arrives discreetly in unmarked boxes. Listen, this is something you need to jump on now before the next news headline stuns the world. Go to MyPatriotSupply.com. That's MyPatriotSupply.com. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's Conspiracy Theory Thursday, and thanks for listening to the Radio Northwest Network, supplying honestly provocative talk for the states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho, the Pacific Northwest states. And I'm glad to let you into the conversation. In fact, if you're a naysayer, you go right to the head of the line at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk at LarsLarson.com. Now, I think most of us have heard that most of the cities in the Pacific Northwest, especially the bigger cities like Portland and Seattle, but even still, Tri-Cities, Spokane, Eugene, they're all running very, very short when it comes to cops. But the other component to public safety hasn't had nearly as much attention paid to it, but it doesn't sound like it's in much better condition. And in fact, it sounds like fire departments are suffering a major staffing crisis, so I thought I'd talk to one of the people who represents firefighters, and that's Portland Firefighters Association President, the union president, Isaac McLennan. Isaac, welcome to the program.
Hey, good morning, Lars. Good to speak with you.
How bad is the problem?
I mean, honestly, this is the worst I've ever seen it, and I've been a firefighter here in Portland for over 20 years, and, you know, I've never seen morale so low amongst our ranks. And, you know, we're dealing with a massive staffing crisis. Firefighters are being forced to work mandatory overtime at a ridiculously large amount.
Does that put lives at risk?
Absolutely. Not only does it endanger firefighters, you know, and our safety because of sleep deprivation, but it also, you know, when we respond on calls, you know, the city, the citizens, the residents in this community, they expect us to show up and be 100% when their emergency strikes.
I mean, because I remember coming in as a reporter when fire departments answered a lot of fire calls. But these days, you don't go to as many fire calls, but you go to a whole bunch of medical calls, don't you?
You know, the statistics are surprising. You know, we actually have responded on roughly the same number of fire calls over the last two decades, somewhere around 3,000 calls.
Isaac, you were breaking up a little bit there, and I want people to hear what you said. You said are the fire calls themselves up or down, or is it more medical calls these days? I want people to hear what you're saying, and your cell phone broke up.
Oh, and I apologize for that service issue. Can you hear me now okay?
Yeah, absolutely.
Excellent. Yeah, so fires on the whole are about the same. Portland Fire responds at just over 3,000 calls are structured fires. And the calls for service have gone up significantly in the last 20 years. While those fires remain the same amount of number of fires, the percentage may drop because we're going a lot more medical emergencies.
Yeah, and those medical emergencies, you can't afford to have people who are working a public safety job show up a little bit drowsy if they're trying to save somebody's life who's either bleeding or burned or otherwise.
Absolutely. You know, when critical medical emergencies happen or structure fires happen in the city of Portland, we need to be there, you know, in within minutes, because ultimately when a cardiac arrest is met or someone's trapped inside of a fire, seconds ultimately count. And we need firefighters to be there, be 100% when they show up.
So Isaac, I understand why, you know, that we had mobs in the streets over the last couple of years demanding defund the cops. And we had city councils that, for whatever crazy reason, maybe a medical problem you could address, they decided to cave into the mobs. And Seattle and Portland and other big cities decided to defund their police. But we didn't have mobs saying defund the firefighters. What's gone wrong?
Well, here's what happened, in my opinion, Lars. You know, a lot of attention has been on the police, right, on both sides. And we understand, you know, obviously that, you know, we need police to be there so that we firefighters can show up and be safe on some of these dangerous scenes. But firefighters, inherently, we do whatever we can with what we have. We are sort of MacGyvers, if you will. If we only have one firefighter to put out a structure fire, we'll figure out how to do it. But the bottom line is we can't do our job unless we have the right number of firefighters on a fire to effectively not only fight that fire, but go in and do rescue, ventilation, and all the other jobs that are required. So why isn't there been attention? Mostly because we don't raise the flag. We just put our noses down and we get to work. And now we're at a tipping point. Firefighters are telling me, my members are telling me, we are tired, we're overworked, we're frustrated, we're understaffed, and we're, you know, these mandatory hours are hurting us. It's affecting our families. Well, when we're forced to work, this is not happening, but like 15 minutes after completing a 24 or 48, or even sometimes a 96-hour shift straight, we're being told we get a call 15 minutes before we're ready to head home that, hey, you're going to have to stay and work another shift. That is incredible. Not only are you sleep deprived, you're exhausted, and now your family's left without you. So if you have to go home and take care of your kids, you've got 15 minutes to figure out your life or what other responsibilities you have to take care of outside of work.
Okay, so tell me this. It's not for lack of funding. The money is there to hire the firefighters. Am I right? And if I'm not, correct me on that. Why aren't we seeing new people come into the fire service? Where's the shortfall happening?
Yeah, I mean, there was kind of a ripple effect. Ultimately, what left us in this gigantic deficit of firefighters. And the problem, the fix really is to hire more firefighters. But through shutting down training and not hiring enough, or even going out and attracting and retaining those firefighters. I mean, just last year, I'll just give you an example. 8 firefighters last year resigned from the fire bureau. That is unheard of. When I came in 20 years ago, nobody resigns. Everybody works their 25, 30-year career and retires. And that the statistics of that, you know, we've never seen resignations before. And I think that's really telling. And I'm nervous because right now there's 67 firefighters that are eligible to retire today. And we're only able to hire 24 firefighters in a year because of staffing cuts over the last 10 years and our inability to have enough trainers to train those firefighters up to be full-fledged firefighters.
I mean, so that means you could lose 67 and only legally have the ability to replace 1/3 of them?
That's correct. Yeah, our ability right now at training is to only hire 24 firefighters a year. That's the rate at which we're hiring. We've done 48 before, but only like 4, 5, 6 years ago, we were hiring at a rate of 48 per year. And through changes from fire chiefs in the past, and reductions from city council looking for budget cuts, that's what we're left with. And, you know, the emphasis is always don't cut frontline services. So we keep those fire engines and fire trucks in service, but we cut those back-end jobs like training, logistics, EMS, those things that keep those frontline services going and provide us the ability to train firefighters so that they're ready for service.
I'll tell you, Isaac, I've seen the same thing in the cops where they have people not retiring, but simply saying, I'm out of here. I'll go to another line of work. I'll go to another community. And it sounds like it's something that City Hall could address if they chose to address it. And it sounds like they're choosing not to. Isaac, give my best to your fellow firefighters, and thanks so much for coming on.
You bet. And thank you for the time today, Lars.
It's my pleasure. That is the union chief, the president of the Portland Firefighters Association, Isaac McLennan. And I don't imagine the problem is much better anywhere else. We'll be back in just a moment. I'll get to your phone calls and your emails. And I got to tell you about a new court decision. Barack Obama broke the law with the DACA, aimed at legalizing the status of illegal aliens, but without the benefit of Congress, and a federal court has finally said that wasn't legal. I'll tell you about the details and get to your calls. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show.
My fellow Americans, tonight I'd like to talk with you about immigration.
That is Barack Obama speaking almost a decade ago and begging the U.S. Congress to pass so-called immigration reform that would have legalized those who have illegally crossed into America and stayed. Now, you might wonder, Lars, why are you talking about what Barack Obama said almost a decade ago? Oh, believe me, I'm going to get to that. There has been a court decision this week. But first, I just want to give you a little bit of background so you understand how we got from there to here. So here's Obama saying we've got to have some immigration reform, which is Democrat code language that means Why don't we make it a whole lot easier for everybody who illegally came into America to just stay, even though they violated our laws? And Obama made this appeal to both of the political parties. Listen.
I want to work with both parties to pass a more permanent legislative solution. And the day I sign that bill into law, the actions I take will no longer be necessary.
Now, it turns out it didn't work. Obama got very little done through the United States Congress. For all of his much vaunted persuasive ability, he clearly, all the way through his presidency and even as a candidate, he thought he was the most persuasive guy in the world. Like, I can sit down with the mad mullahs of Tehran and talk them out of the nuclear bomb. I can talk this or that or the other thing. And it turns out he didn't have much ability at all, and he couldn't get anything done by the Congress. Okay, so be it. In our system, if you want a law and you go to the Congress and you can't persuade the people's representatives to pass it, then you don't get the law. So you know what Obama did? This great self-described constitutional scholar, he broke the law and he created what's known as DACA. Now, that's shorthand for deferred action on childhood arrivals, that addressed really a tiny, tiny part of the problem. There are an estimated 23 to 30 million illegals in America. DACA actually addressed about 800,000 of them, people who had come here as children, although the legal definition of children in this case went all the way up to age 19. I don't consider that a child. That is an adult. Now, it was illegal for Obama to do what he did, and he knew it. Well, yesterday, a federal appeals court ruled that the DACA, the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, is illegal. But then the court said, but because it's been in place for a long time, we're going to let the program stay. But it directed the Biden administration not to add anybody else to it. Now, during his presidency, let's go back to the time when DACA didn't exist. Obama, even at some of his rallies where his own supporters started heckling him, demanding that he act to legalize the illegal aliens. And this is the really important part of this background. Obama, in this case, being heckled by the crowd, explained to the crowd, I don't have the legal power to do that. Listen to this.
If, in fact, I could solve all these problems without passing laws in Congress, then I would do so. But we're also a nation of laws. That's part of our tradition. And so the easy way out is to try to yell and pretend like I can do something by violating our laws. And what I'm proposing is the harder path, which is to use our democratic processes to achieve the same goal that you want to achieve. But it won't be as easy as just shouting. It requires us lobbying and getting it done.
And getting it done. Exactly. Except that Obama was never one for hard work. The hard work of telling the people's representatives, I'm going to make a case. I'm going to be willing to bargain with both sides. He said, I'll work with both sides of the aisle. He didn't do that. He got lazy about it. He finally decided, I'll just sign my name to a piece of paper and declare that I have changed American law. And I want to remind you, American presidents don't have that authority. No president can make a law just by signing his name to a piece of paper. Well, this week, a three-judge panel of the 5th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals upheld a decision from last year out of Texas that said the Obama administration, just as Obama had said, had no authority to impose DACA. Now, the court blocked the Biden administration from enrolling any new illegal aliens in DACA. That would provide them with work permits and shield them from deportation. But it did say the current beneficiaries, about 600,000 of them, could stay in the system. Now, go right back to the creation of DACA. American presidents don't have that power. And yet, about a year after Obama told that mob, that crowd, that he didn't have the legal authority to do it, he did exactly that. And this is the way he announced it.
It makes no sense to expel talented young people who, for all intents and purposes, are American.
Are American. This is where an American president says, I can't do this legally, but I'm going to do it illegally. I should do it through Congress. I'm not going to do it through Congress. I don't have the will. I don't have the persuasive ability. I'm just not going to do it. And then he declares that people, just because they have illegally crossed into America, in some cases were brought as children, that they're just as American as you or me. Take a listen to Barack Obama describing, well, it's just a lack of paperwork. Take a listen.
I've seen the heartbreak and anxiety of children whose mothers might be taken away from them just because they didn't have the right papers. I've seen the courage of students who, except for the circumstances of their birth, are as American as Malia or Sasha. Students who bravely come out as undocumented in hopes they could make a difference in the country they love.
In the country they love. Just a lack of paperwork. Let me tell you something. Have you ever wondered what might happen to you if you showed up at the airport to get on an airplane and you didn't have the paperwork, the picture ID? You don't get on the plane. If you show up at your bank and you don't have the paperwork to open an account, you don't get an account. If you show up at a union job and you don't have a union card in your pocket, that's just paperwork, according to Barack Obama. You don't get to work on that site. So all of those things are paperwork issues. And remember, this is a guy who graduated from one of the most elite law schools in America. And he's simply declaring, well, this is just a paperwork problem. And he appears to ignore the fact that even though he had just finished saying America is a nation of laws, he decides to ignore the law, ignore the Constitution, ignore his lack of authority to do what he's doing. He did this illegally. And finally, almost a decade later, a federal court finally calls him out on it. Now, I might remind you that during the Trump administration, Donald Trump tried to get DACA done away with. And the courts came up with this weird decision where they said, yes, what Barack Obama did was illegal. DACA has no legal basis at all. But to get rid of it, Donald Trump, you have to find a legal reason to get rid of an illegal law. Now, if that sounds crazy to you, it also sounds crazy to me. But this is the craziness we're up against. And now we've got a federal court, and I thank God that they have now decided to declare DACA illegal and tell the Biden administration, don't you dare sign anybody else up for this program, because it's very clear that Joe Biden and his fellow Democrats are desperate. They understand that the American public is angry at them, angry about inflation, angry about energy, angry about massive failures like the exit from Afghanistan, like the tens of billions of dollars going to a strange war where Joe Biden and the Biden crime family have all these ties to Ukraine. They're angry about a lot of things, and Joe Biden is trying to find something that will make them happy. Well, I don't think that allowing people to do things in violation of federal law while at the same time, out of your same mouth, telling Americans you have to obey the laws, but these people don't, I don't think that's going to win you elections. It's not going to win for Democrat governors. It's not going to win for Democrat members of Congress. And it's not going to win for the Democrat Party. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. I'll do that in the next segment. I want to talk about California. Now, there are things about California that just irritate me all day long. They seem to want to dictate to the rest of the United States, the other 50 states, how we live. They want to dictate what kind of car you drive, how energy is produced. The list is very long. But I guess I hadn't thought about the idea that California might effectively dictate what kind of food you eat and how that food is produced. So the guy who's in the know in this is Michael Formica, who is the chief legal strategist for the National Pork Producers Council. Michael, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on.
How might California, and I guess in this case, California voters, actually dictate to the rest of the country what kind of food we eat?
So it probably won't surprise you that California isn't alone in this. Massachusetts voters also tried to do the same thing. Two peas in a pod there. But California is a much larger state. And so in 2018, they passed a law that seeks to regulate how we run all of our livestock farms across the country. And I represent hog farmers. And importantly about hog farmers, there's none of them in California. 99.8% of the pork that California consumes, and they consume a lot of it, comes from outside of the state, and the state is trying to regulate how those farms are run in, you know, all across the country in every state other than California.
Now, Michael, I don't know about you. I'm not a lawyer. I suspect you're. Are you a lawyer?
I'm a lawyer, yes.
You're a lawyer. Well, we have a lot of them. I never wish for more.
We got a lot of them.
I know. God bless you for being a lawyer, I guess, but tell me this. That seems to me, just as an ordinary American who's read the Constitution a couple of times, that seems like a violation of the Interstate Commerce Clause. Am I way out of line on in suggesting that California cannot dictate interstate commerce?
Well, that's my view. I don't believe that California can. They're free to do whatever they want. And if people want to live in California and deal with it, more power to them. I choose not to live in California.
Me too.
Right? Because I don't want to deal with that. And I don't live in Massachusetts either because I don't want to deal with their stuff. But right wherever you live, you have local elected officials. You get to choose the laws that you're going to live under. And that's the beauty of this country. And
right.
California is trying to upset that.
Well, look, Michael, in this case, I suppose California, just imagining their reply to the interstate commerce, because the Constitution says it's clear, the Congress regulates interstate commerce, states can't do it. Because if they could, they'd get up to all kinds of nonsense that would be very easy even for non-lawyers to imagine how they would mess things up. But in this case, I imagine California says, that's right, you don't have to go by our rules, but then again, you don't have to sell your pork in our state either. So do they have the ability to dictate that, say, we're not going to let you, you don't have to go by our rules, raise your hogs everywhere else in America, you just can't sell them in one of the biggest marketplaces in America?
Well, and so that's the problem, because the farmers don't actually sell the pork. If you're a farmer, you're raising an animal, and then you sell that animal to the processor. And the processor makes that decision. So the processor's going to turn, you know, has been pressured by California and is going to go to these farmers and say, if you don't comply with California, we don't care that you live in Indiana or Iowa or, you know, South Dakota. If you don't listen to California, and you don't, importantly, you don't allow California enforcement agents onto your farm, then we're not going to be able to buy your crops, your animals.
So, well, I get, you know, so then it comes down, I guess, to a bit of a standoff. I suppose the hog farmers could say, fine, we're just not going to sell any product, or the producers, you know, the people who turn the hogs into bacon and pork chops and everything else. They can just say, fine, none of that is going to be for sale in California. So good luck. And when the, almost 40 million people in California find out they can't buy bacon anymore, then they get to, I guess, take their pitchforks and torches down to Sacramento, right?
Well, we could do that. That would be incredibly disruptive to the entire country, to the nation's economy. And this isn't something unique to pigs. This is across all of agriculture and really every industry out there. And so luckily, we don't have to go down that path because the U.S. Supreme Court is going to hear my case on Tuesday.
Now, you didn't have any luck with the Ninth Circus Court, as I like to call them, because they're the most overturned appeals court in America. They of course, didn't entertain your idea.
Every case that came up from the Ninth Circuit last term was overturned. That's right. They didn't agree with us.
They're batting 1,000 in legal terms then, right?
They're batting 1,000.
Okay, so at this point, the U.S. Supreme Court takes it up. What's the actual issue? Can you explain it so non-lawyers like me and most of my audience can understand it?
Sure. You know, so this is what us lawyers would call an extraterritorial law. What you or my parents or my brother would call, that sounds unconstitutional, right? California is trying to regulate in another state, and the Constitution doesn't allow that. That's essentially our claim. The Ninth Circuit didn't agree with us. California doesn't agree with us. But the Biden administration agrees with us.
And so are you kidding? I'm going to have to end up praising the Biden administration for one of its positions. That's going to be a red-letter day for me because I don't do that very often.
We have 26 Republican attorney generals. We have one Democrat attorney general from Iowa, and the Biden administration. We have the Chamber of Commerce, the National Association of Manufacturers, Cato Institute, every major food and retail and business organization supporting us, and the Biden administration supporting us because they realize the chaos that would ensue if, you know, if California prevails here. And this isn't just a you know, California trying to regulate, you know, Midwestern states. This could happen with any state, right? New York might try to, you know, New York, think about if you're Vermont and you don't want New York or Massachusetts telling you what to do. You might be liberal, more liberal than I am, but you want to be liberal on your own terms. You don't like somebody else coming into your house and telling you how to live your life.
Well, I'm talking to Michael Formica, who's chief legal strategist for the National Pork Producers. So this doesn't even have to be livestock. This could be washing machines. I mean, because if California says, well, we're going to require that all washing machines have to be green and, you know, run by solar power or something. If they did that and the people who make washing machines say, well, if we want to sell in California, we're going to have to comply with their requirements. So we'll just make all the washing machines in America. California could dictate things beyond food, couldn't they?
California has taken the position in before the Ninth Circuit that they could set a minimum wage for California and use that as a requirement for anyone elsewhere in the country to sell products into California. And so that's great. You know what? The minimum wage that you need to live and the market would bear in San Francisco is a whole lot higher than it is, you know, in Sac County, Iowa.
And they could say, hey, Iowa, you're only allowed to sell any of your products into our marketplace if you meet our minimum wage standards, even though I would imagine a San Francisco minimum wage would probably make you very wealthy if you were living in Davenport, right?
It pretty much anywhere else, yeah.
So
you can be in Tennessee, you could be in Iowa, you can be in you know, Washington State, you know, Idaho, wherever. California,
well,
right? California, you say $45 minimum wage if you want to sell products here.
Are we likely to have to wait till June to hear the outcome on this, or could the Supreme Court give us some relief before then? I've got about 10 seconds.
I think we're going to get a response. We'll hear in January or February.
Very good. That's Michael Formica, who's the chief legal strategist for the National Pork Producers Council. California wants to dictate to the rest of the country how we live. I suggest we tell California to pound sand on that. 866-439-5277. Naysayers go first. Emails to talk at LarsLarson.com. And you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
Joe met Ron DeSantis, and he put on a nice act. He talked climate change, yeah, he sounded deranged, but at least he showed some tact. Then he met with a local mayor, thought the microphones were far away. But it was all recorded, no, it wasn't distorted, cause here's what he had to say. Joe Biden said, hey Ray, you don't tug on Superman's cape, you don't spit into the wind. You don't pull the mask off an old Lone Ranger, and you don't f*** with a Biden. Joe is into blackmail, as he proved with Ukraine. A billion in aid, the payment wouldn't be made. Joe said, let me explain. You see, your prosecutor has Hunter in his sight. I'm worried about what he has planned. He said, it may sound funny, but you get no money unless that lawyers can. Then he said, come on, man, you better give my son a pass, or the aid we will suspend. You don't lay a glove on my boy, Hunter, and you don't f*** with a Biden.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. That's our great Jim Gossett, the parody artist for the Lars Larson Show. And what he's talking about is yesterday. Joe Biden was actually talking to one of the mayors in South Florida. He was there because, you know, the president had to show the flag after the hurricane. And he said, nobody F's with a Biden, which is exactly the way that I would think that the head of the Biden crime family and would speak, and exactly the kind of attitude that he would take. You don't F with a Biden. Yeah, I get it. That's the president of the United States. Mainstream media wasn't interested in that hot mic moment, but I thought you might be. By the way, Joe Biden's own Department of Justice earlier today announced they believe they have enough information to be able to indict Hunter Biden for some of the sleazy deals, also gun charges that he's managed to escape for years. And when they do that, some of that dirt is going to fall back on Joe. This might just be the Democrat Party's way of showing Joe the door. Even though when Joe Biden says, you don't F with a Biden, it seems to me that lately just about everybody has been effing with Biden, from the Saudi sheiks to Vladimir Putin to the Chi-Coms to everybody else. Is there anybody in the world that doesn't F with Joe Biden at this point, despite his declaration to the contrary? On that note, it's a pleasure to welcome back to the program Mark Thielman, former candidate for governor, and he's got a measure 114 event going on this Saturday. I've told you about this crazy ballot measure that will effectively be a ban on the purchase of all firearms by all citizens in the state of Oregon if voters are foolish enough to pass it. Mark, welcome back to the program.
Well, thanks for having me back, Lars. This is my own little way of effing with Biden by being on your show.
Well, you know, we've all got to do it, right? And let's go, Brandon. So tell me about this event. I've told my audience that Measure 114 really is a wolf in sheep's clothing because it effectively bans all purchases of all firearms by all citizens of Oregon if passed by the voters in November. I don't know if you agree with that assessment, but tell me what the event is coming up this Saturday.
Well, it's called the Save Our State Rally, and it's obviously a Second Amendment rally, an anti-114 rally, and it's also a chance to kind of prepare our electorate and our proud, patriotic, engaged people for what I'm hoping will be a historic red wave here in Oregon. So we're going to have a variety of candidates speaking and lots of great, you know, booths and information. Whoa, jeez. See, it just happened. My dog goes crazy.
I've got a dog in the studio, but I feed him enough treats that he usually doesn't give voice.
Well, it's Parker. He's my dog in the fight. So the beauty of it is we're expecting a couple, you know, 3,000 people. We'd like to see 5,000, and it would be a wonderfully timed way to put a shot in the arm for all of the conservative candidates working hard to restore common sense and bring representation and service of the government to the people back to the state. So really want to encourage people to turn out. It's going to be a great time with a lot of like-minded people.
Okay, what time of day this Saturday at the state capitol?
Well, it kicks off at 11 and it goes all through the afternoon. So, you know, you can come and stay for the whole thing or part of it. And, you know, just put in the Save Our State rally. There's an agenda of speakers, a variety of speakers, and obviously subject to change as people are in and out with the crazy politicking going on this close to the election. So I'm looking forward to it. And there'll be food as well, and also opportunity to connect with other patriot-loving organizations. So,
you know, Mark, I've done everything I can to get the supporters of ballot measure 114 on because I want to ask him about this. Why did you write a measure that says to buy a gun, you have to get a permit, but to get the permit, you have to take a class? It must be given by law enforcement, but we're not going to require that law enforcement actually give the class. It's one of the sneakiest approaches I've ever seen to a gun ban because they're going to say, well, it's not actually a ban on guns. You can still buy a gun. You just have to get a permit, and you have to take a class. But law enforcement doesn't have to offer the class. And by the way, we're not funding it, and the sheriffs think it'll cost $30 or $40 million. So in this day and age, if you say, the class must be done by law enforcement, but they're not required to do it, and we're not going to provide them the money to do it, what do you think is going to happen? They're not going to do it.
Well, it was brilliantly written so that basically anybody who now has a gun moving forward is eligible for prosecution by the state.
And all you got to do is have a gun that has a magazine in it that's capable of holding more than 10 rounds. This segment brought to you by NickShivers.com for an instant offer to buy your home immediately. NickShivers.com. Mark, thank you very much. You've got the Lars Larson Show.
Oregon Utility Notification Center wants to remind you that whether you're planting a tree, building a fence, or just making improvements around your farm or home, click or call before you start your work to get the area marked. Then dig safely and avoid contact with buried utilities. You owe it to yourself and your loved ones. Know what's below. Call before you dig. For more information, visit us online at digsafelyoregon.com.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and your emails. We'll do that in just a moment. But if you want to jump into the best conversation in talk journalism, it happens right here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. And welcome to the Radio Northwest Network, serving the Pacific Northwest states of Oregon, Washington, and Idaho for the past 22 and a half years. Our Twitter poll today can be found at Lars Larson Show. And it's a simple question. Should death certificates here in Pacific Northwest states show your real gender or the one you identify with? They are likely to be very different. People have actually raised this issue, suggesting that states should put on your death certificate when you pass away the gender you identify with, not your actual gender. I'm one of those people who doesn't think it's a good idea to mess with public records for a whole bunch of reasons I could outline, but that's the question for today. Twitter poll is brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at ultimatetruckservice.com. Yesterday, we asked you about this crazy plan that January 1, Washington State will add almost half a dollar to the cost of gasoline and diesel in a climate-driven cap and tax scheme that Jay Inslee apparently likes a lot. I don't like it at all. I think they ought to put it on hold. Now, speaking of the climate, are private companies the real answer to public climate change problems if we want to address them? Todd Myers joins me now, who's environmental director with the Washington Policy Center. Todd, welcome back.
Thanks for having me on.
So tell me about this. What is the idea of having private companies address this instead of government agencies, which you've spent, I think, a decade or more pointing out that government agencies are great for setting goals and saying this is the number we're going to achieve, and then they quickly forget about what they said was their goal because they're never going to get there, and they just set new goals. Would private companies do a better job?
Absolutely. And just to give an example of what you just talked about how government doesn't live up to its promises, Washington State, about a decade and a half ago, set a target for all state agencies that 20% of the fuel they purchased would have to be biofuel. Well, the report came out earlier this summer that they missed the target again. They were only at 11%. And it is the 13th year in a row that state agencies have missed the target. So what's so interesting is we have a governor who talks about how important climate change is, but he can't get his own agencies literally to live up to the law of Washington State. But private sector, they do a better job. And if you are concerned about climate change, then you can choose companies that are doing things about climate change and reducing their CO2 emissions. If you don't, you can avoid them. You have that choice. And I think that is one reason that it is better to focus on private answers rather than government answers. But the other issue is that private innovation just does a better job.
Yeah, because the private sector is not driven as much by politics. They're driven by a desire to actually achieve what they're going for because they know that the failure to achieve the goal actually means you lose customers, you lose revenue, and eventually you go out of business. Government just says, yeah, we missed the target. Give us some more money and we'll try better next time.
Yes, and even though we missed the target, if you vote for the other side, they're going to do all sorts of things you don't like on other issues. So they're never really held accountable for individual issues, whereas companies like Microsoft, Amazon, even Walmart recognize that they're held accountable if they don't meet the target. In the case of Walmart, one of the things that they did was find ways to reduce their energy use and CO2 emissions by changing their supply chain and making it more efficient, which is why they not only met their goals, they exceeded them because they found that they were finding ways to save money and use less gasoline, which is good for their bottom line. So that's, you know, there are multiple incentives for private sector businesses to achieve these goals and stick to them and be held accountable to them because it actually often helps, their bottom line and save money.
You know, the only place I'd like to wall off from that kind of choice is government itself. And Todd, let me explain why. Something crossed my, I read a lot of stuff at night trying to prepare for the next day's show. And I've got a real concern right now. You're familiar with the term ESG, environmental, social, and governance?
Yes, exactly.
Well, and it's one thing if I said, well, I want to subscribe to ESG. People could say, okay, Lars, if you want to buy stocks in companies that are environmentally woke and all that, go ahead. You might take a lower return, but that's your choice. The problem is right now, a whole bunch of the blue states, including Oregon and Washington, have their state treasurers who've signed on to ESG. And then a number of other states, more natural resource states like, say, Louisiana, saying we're not going to cut our own throat by subscribing to ESG so that things like the oil industry, which is huge in Louisiana, gets cut off from money. We're not going to do that. And what it got me thinking was, if Oregon and Washington say, well, we subscribe to ESG, what they're not telling the voters and the taxpayers is we are going to voluntarily take a lower rate of return on state investments, monies that they've stuffed into various accounts, including pensions for public workers. We'll take a lower rate of return so that we can be, you know, woke and PC and, you know, save the planet. Well, that's all well and good, except that if they take a lower rate of return, you know who gets to make up the difference? The taxpayers.
Well, that's exactly right. And there are even instances where they will say, oh, no, no, we're not taking a lower rate of return. We're actually seeing a better rate of return. But there's, of course, higher risk that's associated with that, which is important. But the other issue is that it is regulation under the guise of the free market. What you're doing, what the state is doing, is using pensioners' money, taxpayer money, money that has been paid as an obligation to influence the behavior of businesses. That's no different than regulation or subsidies. It just looks a little different and they just pretend it's different. So I agree with you. I think when you use state pensions and state money to pressure private organizations to follow particular, you know, agendas, it's no different than if you were doing it through regulation.
See, and that's the concern I've got. And if they tell you, you can get the same rate of return, really? So why do people put their money into, say, the oil industry? And you say, because it has a good rate of return and it's fairly stable. I mean, there's demand for the product. You know, these companies know how to make the product, but we're going to choose not to invest in them. We'll choose in, you know, something that's more woke or more politically correct. And you say, well, hold on, you can do that without losing anything? If that were the case, you wouldn't need to do ESG groups where you say we're going to deliberately invest in these lower return things, because if they're actually higher return things, you wouldn't have to persuade people to go and invest in them. So I don't necessarily buy the
argument.
And I'm very concerned that state treasurers are selling us out because they don't have to care. It's not their money that they're wasting. That's Todd Myers, who's the environmental director with the Washington Policy Center. Todd, it's always a pleasure. Thanks very much for what you do at WPC. Now, your phone calls and emails are welcome at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Coming up in a moment, John Adams warned us hundreds of years ago that we should be a nation of laws, not a nation of men. Well, guess what? The Biden DOJ is now picking and choosing who faces criminal charges and whether or not they like your politics or not. I'll explain up next on The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'll get to your phone calls here in just a moment. But I want to make a point, and I've cited this example before, because John Adams from America's history, one of our founders, made a very important point a couple of hundred years ago. He said, America is a nation of laws, not a nation of men. And I've confessed that back in junior high when we were taking, you know, American history, I really didn't understand that. I said, can we be both a nation of laws and a nation of men? And the answer is no, you really can't. If you're a nation of laws, then the laws apply to everybody equally. If you're a nation of men, then depending on who finds favor with the government. And the government can be at the local level. It could be the mayor, could be the governor, could be the county commissioner, could be the president or a member of Congress. That in some foreign countries, for instance, say Saudi Arabia, if you're in tight with the Saudi royal family, you can almost do no wrong. If you're not in tight with the Saudi royal family, it doesn't matter what you do, you're not going to get any advantage. In America, the laws should treat everybody equally. Except that right now, right in front of us, we're seeing a terrific example of a nation of men rather than a nation of laws. And it involves the Joe Biden administration and specifically his Department of Justice. Now, over the last several months, I've told you that there have been attacks on pro-life groups. There have been attacks on Christian churches, especially pro-life Christian churches. And in some cases, in a couple of dozen of the cases, they have gone in and the bad guys in this case, Jane's Revenge is what the group is, they're not even afraid to announce publicly, we did this. Now, They go in and they firebomb a pregnancy resource center. They trash the building. They break the windows. They trash the office space. These are crimes that are not just frightening, but they're tremendously damaging to groups that are only involved in, at its base, First Amendment free speech. That is, a pregnancy resource center simply says to young women who are pregnant, if you're pregnant and you think the only option you have is to terminate that pregnancy through an abortion, we can tell you about the alternatives. They have no special power. They have no, you know, special ability to force anybody, a young pregnant woman, to do differently than what she plans. And in fact, when I've talked to people from the pregnancy resource centers, these are usually backed up by Christian groups, they say, look, a young lady can walk in and say, I'm pregnant. I don't know what I'm going to do. I'm considering aborting my pregnancy. And they can say, well, we can help you to have that baby safely and then give it up for adoption, have that baby safely, and then be able to have the resources to be able to raise that child as your own. All of these are other options open to you. That's what they do. In other words, basically freedom of association, freedom of assembly, and freedom of speech. That's all the pregnancy resource centers are doing. They've been attacked. And as I said, some of the folks who've attacked them, Jane's Revenge, have announced, we did this crime. And the FBI has yet to arrest a single suspect in 150 attacks on pro-life groups and pro-life churches. On the other hand, when it comes to issues that Joe Biden and the Joe Biden White House and the DOJ don't agree with, well, then all of a sudden the DOJ is going to town. Yesterday, the Department of Justice announced charges against 11 pro-life protesters who they say violated federal law against blocking abortion clinics. And if you say, if you're saying to yourself about now, hey, Lars, we had a couple of years of people who rioted in American cities, set fire to buildings, looted businesses, in some cases even murdered people, and very few of those people saw any punishment at all. In this case, the Biden DOJ has decided that seven of the demonstrators were charged with conspiracy against the rights secured by the Freedom of Access to Clinic Entrances Act, an act passed by Congress called FACE. It prohibits obstructing the entrance to an abortion facility. The other four were charged with violating the legislation. Now, the FBI has already raided the home of one man, a Catholic, Chester Gallagher, organizer of the protest, and one of the accused conspirators. They showed up at his house with guns drawn. Now, this is the kind of arrest they stage for somebody who is pro-life. On the other hand, if you're pro-abortion and you go out and trash a pregnancy resource center, you trash a pro-life Christian church, what happens is next to nothing. The FBI simply doesn't act. That is a nation of men, not a nation of laws. If there are laws against trashing people's churches, trashing people's offices, they ought to be applied equally. But that's not how the Biden administration is rolling right now. They have decided if you're on their side, they're going to let you get away with just about everything. If you're not on their side, they're going to see if they can put you in jail. On that note, let's go to a naysayer. Richard, welcome to the program. What's on your mind today?
Hello again, Lars. You had a guy on here a while back ago talking about the marijuana stuff, and I've heard your arguments about how we said that the crime was going to go down and all sort of stuff. We have, I admit, we do have slavery in here in Oregon through it, but I personally believe that once we get marijuana nationwide legal, it'll take all the incentive away from all of the criminals doing that stuff. And we have a good, perfect example of that, you know, Al Capone back in the 20s and 30s. Now, if you don't think he didn't have people running, you know, bootlegging whiskey and stuff and making booze for him with, you know, the threat of a Chicago typewriter, you're crazy.
Well, can I suggest that there will still be an illegal market, and I'll tell you why. Because in every place in America where they've legalized pot, the state says, but we get a cut. In other words, the state will say smoking is bad, but boy, we get a cut on those cigarettes. Booze is bad, but we get a gigantic markup or a gigantic tax on the booze that's sold. The government is happy to declare all kinds of things wrong but legal as long as they get a gigantic cut. So if you're somebody who grows pot illegally and even produces things like hash oil and dabs and things like that, I'm not a fan of pot, so I don't use it myself. That's my bias in the case. But if the state says we're going to get 20, 25, 30% of what you sell it for, the guy or gal who's doing it illegally is going to say, I'm going to sell mine without that gigantic markup, and I'm still going to be in business. Now, if that were the case, when Al Capone was in the booze business, if they had immediately said, well, we've gotten rid of, we've done the constitutional amendment, we got rid of prohibition, and you can now make booze, but we're going to have a gigantic tax on it, and the illegal booze makers said, well, we can sell below that price point and still make money, then those people would have stayed in that business. And I suspect they probably would have. Yeah.
They still are. And there's even still rum runners and that kind of stuff into Utah. There's people who go outside of the state of Utah to buy alcohol and bring it back in there and sell it for a higher price. If that's not illegal, I don't know what is.
Exactly. So what you're defeating.
People are going to do what they're going to do.
But you're going to defeat your own argument, because your argument is once it's all legalized nationwide, there will be no reason for the criminals to be involved in that business. But the fact is, as long as they can make a profit and as long as government decides it's only going to be legal if we get a big fat cut out of what is sold and the price it's sold for, as long as that's the case, as long as government's around, there will always be crime. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. And as you can see, naysayers go to the head of the line on the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to take your phone calls, and I'll do that in just a moment. But I want to talk to our friend Carl Szabo, who's vice president of Net Choice and a professor of internet law at George Mason University's Scalia Law School. Carl, good to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
So the U.S. Supreme Court announced on Monday, beginning of its term, that it was going to hear some nine different cases, including one called Ronaldo Gonzalez versus Google. So one ordinary citizen who lost his daughter tragically in the Paris terrorists attack back in 2015, he says that Google played a role in that. And the whole question, if I understand this right, help me understand this, is whether or not the Supreme Court of the United States will say that Gonzalez has a right to even bring a lawsuit against Google. Is that it?
Yeah. So I think we can all agree that we want websites to remove terrorist content like ISIS content. And I think we can all agree that we want to hold terrorists personally responsible for their atrocities.
Yep.
A lot of conservative principles, like the ones I believe in personal responsibility. What this case is essentially saying is because Google, in its search algorithm, as they try to block as much terrorist content as they can, failed to block some ISIS content. Well, that means Google is responsible for the ISIS attacks that took place in France and killed this young girl. Now, what happened is horrible. I think we can also all agree that Google is certainly not in the ISIS promotion business. And so what we're talking about right here is a court that needs to or wants to twist itself into knots and say, you know what, Google, I know you'd try to get all the terrorist content, but because you weren't perfect, we're going to hold you responsible. That seems to be the outcome the court would have to reach to rule in favor of the plaintiff in this case. And as just somebody who's on the internet nonstop, I'd much rather that Google and whomever else get 98, 99% of the terrorist content rather than not even try, which is essentially what the choices are before the court here. They can either say, if you try, you try your hardest and you fail to get it all, that's okay as long as you tried, rather than saying, you know what, if you don't try at all, we're not going to hold you responsible for anything.
I guess, Carl, I'm a conservative as well, and I see this just a little bit differently because, for example, I do a talk show, and it is basically I'm a publisher. You know, I know most people don't think of radio as a publisher, but you are. You're a publisher if you're in radio, TV, newspapers, anything else. If you allow information on that causes people damage, then you suffer the consequences. For example, if I catch 99 out of 100 F-bombs, and people do occasionally throw them on this show, but I miss the 100th one, do you know what the FCC says? They say you still get to pay a $300,000 fine. And I say, but I got 99 of them. You say, well, you're a publisher. You decide what goes on the air. When Google acts like a publisher, not like a platform, they're not, I always imagine the platform as being like putting up a blackboard in the town square in a little town and saying anybody can write anything they want to write up on the blackboard. And there will be no, you know, and we may take down death threats, but other than that, everything goes up there. Google seems perfectly capable, and they do, censoring out conservative points of view and things they don't like, apparently because of the politics of the people who run Google and the other tech companies. And then all of a sudden they miss when, not only in Gonzalez's case, if I understand it, went beyond just allowing some ISIS recruiting videos to go on there, but algorithms that actually pointed people, that they said, well, based on the other sites you've gone to, you might be interested in seeing this ISIS recruiting video. They were actually pointing information to some of the users of Google. Is that not the case?
So when we look at what's going on, it's not as though somebody at Google is thinking, ooh, ISIS, we should support and promote their content. The way the algorithms are structured is that if you happen to like something, if I like dog videos, I'm more likely to see dog videos.
Right.
If I am interested in coffee, I'm more likely to see posts about coffee. In this case, it was people who are interested in terrorist content. Therefore, they are more likely to see some terrorist content. Is that great? Absolutely not. But it's not as though somebody at Google was actively trying to make sure that we're promoting terrorist content. Taking a step back to the publisher question, what we're looking at here is the way the law is structured. If a website does absolutely nothing to moderate content, if we talk about websites like 4chan or 8chan, which are absolute cesspool corners of the internet,
dark
where
web.
Anything
yep.
goes all the time, yeah, they assume no liability for any and all of the content that is posted. But as soon as they try to remove ISIS content, terrorist content, child abuse, child grooming, stuff like that, then they assume liability for 100% of the content. So what we have done is our tort system, our legal system, is actually creating a disincentive to do the right thing. So every state in this country has what is called the Good Samaritan Law. If I see somebody struggling to breathe on the side of the road, and in the process of giving them CPR, I happen to break their ribs, they can't sue me for breaking their ribs because we want to encourage people to do the right thing.
Right.
What we have for the internet is a similar law. It's called the Good Samaritan Law. And in it, if you are a website and you try to remove lawful but awful content like terrorist speech, we're not going to hold you liable for all the speech that you happen to miss because we want to encourage people to do the right thing. So at the end of the day, as a conservative, am I frustrated by some of the content moderation and removal of conservative content by some of the tech companies? Absolutely. But I would much rather have them do that than have the government do that. I would much rather have them do that than leave up a lot of this lawful but awful content. And this case is centered around the notion of they were trying to do the right thing. They're trying to remove as much ISIS content as they can. They happen to like fail in this case. Second thing I think is important to note is this is not holding the terrorists responsible for their actions. We're trying to find somebody else to blame for the outcome.
And only because the terrorists, if they sat and made these little cute videos in their terrorist headquarters, wherever they happen to be, it wouldn't matter much because they're not getting out to billions of people on planet Earth, potentially. But if you facilitate getting them out to all these places, are you part of the problem? In other words, if you decide you're going to rob a liquor store and you tell me, you know, say, hey, I need a ride downtown. Why? Because I'm going to go rob a liquor store. And I say, well, I'm not giving you a ride downtown. If I give you a ride downtown knowing what you're doing, even though I'm not directly involved in it, am I culpable?
And that's the exact fact. The thing here is, and what we're talking about is a legal term called mens rea, the knowledge standard.
The dirty, the guilty Google, mind.
Yeah. Exactly. Google had no actual knowledge of this. That's what's, like, the plaintiffs in this case, the people who, the victims in this case,
aren't even saying Google actually knew what they were saying or promoting or doing. And
it was on their site.
So that's, yeah, it happened to be there. So this would be like holding Starbucks responsible when bank robbers met at Starbucks to rob a bank. They met,
Carl,
at the location, they met at the platform, and it's really tough.
Bring it back to my show. If I'm not paying attention and somebody drops an F-bomb and it gets on the air, and I wasn't paying attention to what's on my show, then I'm not doing my job. And I guess I'd say if Google chooses to be a platform for literally hundreds of millions of comments and edits some of it so you're capable of editing it, and then you say, well, we just happened not to be paying attention to what was on our own site, I think I would hold them responsible, but that's okay. Carl Szabo is vice president of NetChoice and a professor of internet law at George Mason University's Scalia Law School. Carl, it's always a pleasure. Glad to have you on. Back in a moment. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. This segment of the show on the Radio Northwest Network is brought to you by Valhalla Tea Company. It's made by veterans to help veterans by donating a dollar from every bag sold at ValhallaTea.com. That's ValhallaTea.com. You know what I'm going to ask you for before I go to calls? I want to find somebody who does this for a living, who moves automobiles for a living. And you know what I'm talking about? The big trucks that you see rolling down the roads that have six or eight automobiles on them, because they're being hauled either to an auto auction, in some cases they're brand new cars, they're going to a dealership. It is something that I'll admit I was remiss in not thinking about. Turns out that all these electric cars weigh a whole lot more than a gasoline-powered car. Now, I've mentioned that in passing, but I didn't think about the overall implications. I mean, years ago, I drove one of those Teslas, and I drove it only out of curiosity, because I wasn't planning to buy it, but they said, would you like to drive one around? I said, so I drove it around for about 20 minutes, and I thought it was interesting. It is noticeably heavier, you know, so maybe on cornering that works better. But here's the problem. It turns out, because if you think about what the greenies have in mind for us, they say, why, we're going to switch everybody to electric cars. Just so you know the sort of the parameters of that problem, Americans own in personal transportation vehicles, this is not commercial vehicles, about 300 million cars and trucks. That's personal transportation. And they're almost all but a couple of million of those 300 million are gasoline and diesel powered vehicles. We buy about 16 to 17 million new cars and trucks every year, and the average car or truck on the road is about 13 or 14 years old. Those are the numbers, so you understand the scale of this. This is why I've suggested that if we ever get to the point where they're producing 2 million electric cars a year, why, it would only take 150 years to replace all the cars in America with electric cars. But then there's this problem. Apparently, the folks who haul the cars around, according to Reuters, the industry says current weight limits on trucks going around the U.S. are outdated and they're not equipped for the imminent pivot to battery-powered EVs. So this is one of the problems I hadn't thought about. Currently, federal highway safety standards restrict trailers to 80,000 pounds gross vehicle weight. Well, that was set back in 1975 when a Honda Civic weighed just under 1,600 pounds, about half as much as one weighs today. But the EPA says the average car truck on the roads has gone from 3,200 to 4,200 pounds over the last 40 years, but the EVs are even heavier than that. In fact, in some vehicles, the GMC Hummer EV, one-third of its weight, or 3,000 pounds of its weight, is from the battery alone. And the folks who haul the vehicles are saying, you got to change the rules, because otherwise we're not going to be able to haul very many cars on each one of those big trucks. And that's going to lead to supply chain problems. So there's one more problem to work out. Now, let's go to a naysayer. First, as always, Eddie, what do you and I disagree about today?
Hey, Lars, thanks for having me on the show. And I wanted to go ahead and, just talk about the effects of marijuana on the homeless population in Portland and how that is or isn't adding to the current drug problem.
Okay. Go ahead, Eddie.
And, yeah, so my case in point would be that weed specifically wouldn't be adding to the drug problem of, like, the homeless, just because weed, like, physiologically is
less addictive than alcohol.
Hold on. Eddie, can I read you something I just saw today from the CDC that goes right to your point? The CDC says some people who use pot will develop marijuana use disorder. I guess they call it MUD. 3 people out of 10 who make regular use of pot will develop this this effect, this disorder, and they will be unable to quit. So it's addictive, it sounds like, for very close to 1/3 of everybody who uses it. You want to start over talking about addiction?
Yeah. I guess I would want to really kind of like lead my point to being how would weed lead into the effect of, you know, other potentially like more harmful drug use that we
I'm not even see I'm not like even arguing population. Gateway. I'm saying if weed gets you addicted 3 times out of 10, so people are stuck on the drug and they can't quit it. Okay? That's going to be a problem, isn't it? And it I believe it is one of the gateway drugs. I mean, I do believe that, but that's a separate argument. Let's just take this one. And then add into that, Eddie, do you know about the studies on psychosis? That regular use of pot, just regular use of the regular, legally available recreational pot, as they like to call it, causes a dramatic increase in people who become psychotic. Now, the British have been talking about this for years. There are medical studies published in some of the major journals that say it increases the number of psychotics. Do you think that the reason a lot of those people are living on the streets right now is because they're more than a little bit crazy?
I do believe that, yeah. However,
do you believe that pot lends to that?
Yes. I would believe that a lot of those people living on the streets are psychotic. However, I want to say that a lot of those people are genetically predispositioned to be psychotic, right? And whether it's weed or any other like substance that would not be including like alcohol, another like which is like a depressant, obviously, is very likely to, you know, push them over that edge into being psychotic. So
is that going to be good for the rest of us? If we have something that pushes people, it's like if you're predisposed to diabetes and they need a lot of Krispy Kremes and it pushes you over the top, it'd be a good idea not to eat Krispy Kremes, right?
Yeah, no, that's a good point. But
That's all I'm saying, Eddie. Glad to have the naysayer call. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.